Session number 10093, reel 1.
Vice Marshal Bud Wilson, Reel 1. I think before the Second World War you had a serious accident. Can you tell me how it occurred?
I was flying a BA Swallow in September 1938, and something went wrong with the controls, and we crashed, and I entered RAF Cramwell Hospital, and thereafter I moved down to Uxbridge and I came under Archibald Mackindo, who was seconded to the RAF as a plastic surgery expert.
What was the nature of your injuries?
I had facial injuries. In fact, I lost my nose and I only had the remains of a stump at the end of it, and so Mackindo took me under his wing and performed about 4 operations. And it turned out that I was the second casualty in the hospital, Queen Victoria Hospital at East Grinstead. And I had been named the number 2 guinea pig from that time onwards.
Were there burns that you suffered from?
No, I just crashed my face into the windscreen and instrument panel of this BA Swallow.
So Mackindo wasn't specifically a burns expert then?
He was a plastic surgery expert, and he took burns under his wing, I think, generally. But East Grinstead grew into the famous Burns Hospital under his guidance.
Can you tell me what he was like as a man?
The best way I can describe Mackindo is that when he came to see you before an operation, he gave you such confidence of his capabilities and his dynamic personality that regardless of what he did with you while you're under operations, you'd be quite happy. You put your faith in his hands, and he and his team of theatre operators were just truly magnificent.
What did he look like?
He was a Firstly, he was a New Zealander. He was medium height, a little bit chubby, but a bubbling personality.
Did he speak with a New Zealand accent?
No, he didn't. He was the son-in-law of Sir Harold Gillies, who was a famous plastic surgery expert in World War I. And in fact, one time he took me along to consult Sir Harold Gillies on my particular injuries.
Was he a jolly man or serious?
Very jolly. Very, very jolly indeed. And as I say, he and his team gave absolute confidence to any of the subjects that he had on the operating table or in the wards.
How did he spell his name? Do you know?
Mackindo. Mackindoe.
Can you tell me about the Guinea Pigs Club, what you know of it?
The only thing I know about it is that it was formed in about 1941 under a team of people who were in East Grinstead, and I think the team was led by Tom Tom Gleave and Jeffrey Page were two of the stars of the Guinea Pig Club, and they pushed it along, and everybody who had been operated on by McIndoe became a member.
What kind of activities do you carry out today in the club?
I do not attend the Guinea Pig Club any longer, but they do have a meeting, a get-together once a year in about September at East Grinstead, and it's a very jolly occasion, I'm told.
Do you have any special insignia or ties?
Yes, you have a guinea pig tie, which has a little, it's a reddish tie with a little guinea pig on it, and likewise there is a metal badge, I'd call it, which is of a guinea pig, and you can put it in your lapel if you wish to do so.
And you're the second guinea pig, are you?
I'm number two. When East Grinstead opened for McIndoe, then one other flight lieutenant, whose name I've forgotten, I'm afraid, he and I were in a little ward by ourselves, and thereafter the civilians were moved out and more military people came in. But I was only in there for a very short time in about January 1940.
Now, coming on to the outbreak of the Second World War, could you tell me what your personal reaction was when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
War was declared on against Germany on the 3rd of September 1939. And we had moved to our war station, which happened to be the civilian airfield at Croydon. And I remember the squadron listening to the broadcast made by the Prime Minister, Chamberlain, at approximately 1100 hours in the morning of the declaration of war with Germany. At the time, there was a general feeling of let's get on with it, and there was no fear or anything like that. We thought we had one of the best aircraft in the world, which was the Hawker Hurricane, and that we could take on the Germans. And there was no worry amongst the squadron as regards the casualties that would appear thereafter.
Did you feel at that time that you were superior to the Luftwaffe?
I don't think we really thought very much about superiority. We thought we'd present them with a good fight. I at the time was not operational. I was acting as adjutant to the squadron and just about to be ready to come back into flying again, proper flying, fighter flying. I had up to that time just flown communication aircraft while awaiting the operations.
At what time did you personally get operational again?
I became operational on Hurricanes in March 1940, having done the conversion course at Aston Down first, but that was on Gladiators. That was only to get me back into flying practice, and then I did my checkout in a Hurricane at Debden, RAF Debden, in March.
Can you tell me what you thought of the Hurricane as a plane?
I thought the Hurricane was a very good aircraft and a very sturdy aircraft, and very manoeuvrable. for that particular time.
What was it like to fly?
The very pleasant aircraft to fly, and very straightforward and easy, really. It didn't have any vices. You could put it into a spin, and you could do all the aerobatics, and it never, as we say, bit a pilot. A pilot could always cope with it.
How do you mean, bit a pilot?
Well, you have some aircraft that suddenly produce unexpected manoeuvres. They flip onto their backs and that sort of thing. But the Hurricane would never do that. It would go into a straightforward spin, and after a turn or two, you could easily get it out by using the right control movements.
So you felt it was reliable?
Very reliable. And it had a very sturdy undercarriage, which stood it in very good stead later on in the war.
We sometimes nowadays see pictures of aircraft which have been personalised in various ways, with successes put up in pictorial form on the aircraft. Were the RAF doing that type of thing in those days?
As the war went on, yes, there were one or two people who glamorized their Hurricanes and their Spitfires by putting the number of victories on their aircraft. This was not a usual thing to do, and I think it was just for personal glory, really, that any officer did it. I think Stamford Tuck was the first one to do it. Later on, there was another thing that happened, was wing leaders. If you were leading two or more squadrons, you were permitted to put your own initials on the side of the aircraft. And this was a normal and dumb thing. But as for putting swash stickers on or Italian markings on the side of aircraft, I think majority of people thought it was a bit of a line shoot.
Which squadron were you with in March 1914?
I was with number 17 Squadron. And we were based, having started at Croydon, when war was declared, we then moved to RAF Debden.
What kind of an airfield was that?
It was a grass airfield, fairly big airfield, quite suitable for the Hurricane. And as towards May 1940, we were moving forward on a share basis to Marsham Heath on the east coast. From there, we used to carry out numerous, and I say numerous, every day and two or three times a day, convoy patrols protecting the ships coming up the up and down the east coast of England. And they very sensibly had balloon barrages attached to the ships, and this was a deterrent to any German aircraft trying to do a low-level attack on them. But it meant going round and round the ships, and it was the most boring exercise, because you never knew when a German fighter would come up and have a crack at you.
Did that actually happen?
It did once or twice, yes, and we had some success against German bombers that were coming in against the convoys.
Did you personally shoot any down during the defence of those convoys?
No, I don't think I did. My record on that one, I don't think I did have any luck. I did later.
What kind of a squadron was 17 Squadron in terms of the morale?
Morale was extremely good. There were pilots who had been together considerable length of time, and there was no bickering or anything like that. They were all flat out for the squadron spirit, and performed excellently in the air. The first shock of the war came on in May, beginning of May, when the squadron was ordered to take part from Markham Heath to do a patrol over The Hague of Holland. And I tossed up with a chap called Holton Harrop, a young pilot officer, to see whether he or I would go as 12th man, because we both became operational roughly the same time in the squadron. And I lost the toss, and Holton Harrop went on the raid. They were led by the squadron commander, 12 aircraft, in rather tight Hendon-type formation. And
Hendon-type?
Hendon-type. That means a very close formation.
As in air displayers?
As in air displayers, which was a pretty fatal thing to do, particularly in war, as we learned very quickly thereafter. Five members of the squadron were shot down on that first patrol. It included the squadron commander, the senior flight commander, Holton Harrop, and I think two sergeants. The squadron commander returned ultimately by a British destroyer to Harwich, but then Holton Harrop remained as a prisoner of war for the rest of the war. The other people were killed in the fight. This was a terrific lesson to one, and it really did shake the squadron, because the wives of the missing people came daily to the officers' mess and hung around waiting for information as to the return of their husbands. And I think some of us vowed that we wouldn't marry until things got more settled.
Was this sortie during the German invasion of the Netherlands?
It is correct. It is absolutely on the push through that the Germans started about May the 10th. And it was a terrible lesson to the squadron to have to lose the squadron commander and a senior flight commander.
Do you think morale was shaken by that?
It was shaken, but we were a pretty robust sort of chaps, and we were then ordered to patrol, convoy patrols again, and things went back to normal. As I say, the squadron commander returned a few days later and resumed his command, and likewise we got other pilots posted in.
Can you tell me what part you took in the Battle for France in those days of May and June?
Yes. As I said, we were stationed on a rotating basis at the Markisham Heath, going backwards and forwards to our main base, which is at Debden. About the 13th of May, we were ordered to return to Debden and to remove our up-to-date radios and go back to our old-type radios. And because the message came through that we were moving to France. This took place on the 14th of May, and when I say move to France, that is virtually on a daily basis. The answer to that was that they didn't want to keep too many fighter squadrons in France overnight. Thus, quite a few squadrons rotated, went across every day, and then back at dusk to France. And on about the 14th of May, it was on the 17th of May that the squadron were ordered down to Hawkinge on the southeast coast, and from there we were ordered to go down to and land at a station near Lille called Merville, and it is on while at Merville we got talking with the pilots of the Hurricane squadrons that had been based in France since the outbreak of war, and we heard that the Germans were beginning to shoot at pilots in their parachutes. This brought the lessons of war very quickly to us, because it is obvious to us that the esprit de corps, or the rules of war, were going to change in World War II in comparison with the fighting that took place in the RFC when in World War I, because nobody would ever shoot at a man having left his aircraft and was hanging in a parachute. But this was a lesson that we learnt very quickly.
Did the people who told you this seem bitter about it?
Yes, they were. They were very bitter and very surprised. And it was a warning to us immediately that we would have to protect the chap's parachute as he descended.
Did they feel that they would do the same to the Germans?
No. I don't think I know of any case of an RAF pilot strafing a man in his hood bailed out. The lesson that particular day was doubly loaded, really, because on our first sortie that we were scrambled to take part in, we were told that the Germans were strafing refugees going along the road south of Lille. And when we flew into the area, we saw these thousands upon thousands of refugees walking along the road, horse carts and bicycles and women and children. And to know that the Germans were strafing people retreating like this, it was a double shock that day. And we were actually scrambled to take on these German strafers. We didn't find the strafers, but we found a Dornier on reconnaissance, escorted by two ME-110s, and we ploughed into them, and I think we shot them all down, all three of them. I had the pleasure of shooting at the bomber, or the reconnaissance Dornier, and it went down in flames.
Where would this have been?
This would be south of Lille, a place I think called Seclan.
And do you know the date?
It was on the 18th of May, 1940, that we undertook this interception.
Did you see whether any of the Germans bailed out?
I do not have it recorded that anybody got out of it, out of that particular bomber. I should like to go back on to the 17th of May, because this was really the first patrol that our squadron had done. We were told to patrol around Brussels. A flight were to go north and B flight were to go south. A flight had the luck to intercept 24 Ju-87s and shot down six of them. But our commanding officer tried to outturn a Ju-87, which in actual fact is an impossible job task. And regrettably, he spun and then crashed into the ground. But once again, he walked away from the crash, and that is really the last time we saw him as a squadron commander. He returned and to England and went into training command. Also, we lost a flying officer, Lines, L-I-N-E-S, on that particular sortie.
You talked about the German strafing of civilians, but Some people say that it's difficult to distinguish between troops and civilians on the roads. Do you think that's any excuse?
No, the only excuse is one can see the reason for the strafing, and that was to clear the roads in France for the Panther division or divisions to move through to their objectives. And I don't see any other reason for it. But they must have caused absolute mayhem to the French refugees. And it's a memory that sticks in one's mind ever since.
Do any other dogfights stick in your mind from the Battle of France?
Yes. We had quite a few fights, but not really dogfights as one calls them, really. They were straightforward interceptions against 109s around Cambrai. And Cambrai was being attacked at the time, and smoke was rising. And I remember one ME-109 getting on my tail, and I flew through the smoke of Cambrai. And when I came out the other side of it, the 109 wasn't on my tail anymore, so I don't know what happened to him, but I managed to shake him off. We did have quite a lot of interceptions, and we had a fair amount of success. But the point I think I'd like to register about the Battle of France, we were never trained and never asked to strafe Germans on the ground. If we had have been trained this way, then our successes would have been very high. Likewise, our casualties would have been very high as well, going against the Panther ACAC that they had at that time.
Why was it that you weren't trained to do this, do you think?
Well, the Hurricane was an interceptor. It wasn't a ground attack aircraft as defined in those days. And we weren't really trained for army cooperation. We had army cooperation squadrons, but likewise, they weren't equipped with aircraft that are suitable, as we understand them now, for taking on troops on the ground, on the march.
Did you operate over Dunkirk?
Yes. As Dunkirk was approaching, our daily trips to France were reduced, and we then stood by for the evacuation of our troops from Dunkirk. And I have in my logbook the recording that our first patrol over Dunkirk was on the 26th of May. And we were up about twice a day over Dunkirk. I think that is the way the Air Officer Commanding 11 Group was operating the numbers of squadrons he had under command. He allocated two patrols per squadron over Dunkirk all the time from dawn till dusk. Thus everybody had a crack of it, and likewise he had a continuous flow of fighters over Dunkirk. I know that the army, when they returned from Dunkirk, having had a very rough time of being bombed and strafed, etc., by the Germans, accused the fighter squadrons and the RAF